This is the Decibel Geek Podcast.
Thank everybody who's been waiting for probably a very long time for this episode. This is the infamous Vinnie Vincent episode. Starting about 2 years ago, I started talking to someone who knew a lot of inside information about Vinnie Vincent. And being a big-time Kiss fan and knowing what an enigma that Vinnie Vincent is, obviously, I was curious to hear this stuff because Vinny had kind of disappeared over the last 15, 20 years. To my crazy surprise, he turns out he lived just a couple of minutes, or actually well, about 10 minutes away from where I live now in Tennessee. And I knew he had lived in Tennessee, but I didn't know how close he was to me. But I kept that information under wraps. Didn't want to invite nutty stalkers coming in to bother the guy because I was a fan of his growing up, even though, you know, you're going to hear a lot of things that have definitely tainted my opinion of him over the years, but it's just my opinion. My source told me about this, and it kind of put a bug in my ear to maybe possibly write. Originally, it was going to be write a magazine article about Vinnie Vincent using the information he gave me to sort of update people on where he was now and a little bit about what we had found out about him that not the masses didn't know. And let me go ahead and put it out there that if you're listening to this and you obviously care about Vinnie Vincent, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to dog me for doing this an episode on Vinnie Vincent, which that's fine. I know he's probably not the most relevant person that there is in music history, but for those of us that are Kiss geeks and geeks on 80s rock music and that have a fond memory of that era, you know, let us enjoy our time and we want to, you know, discuss this stuff. Let us geek out. And if you don't want to geek out on it, fine, find somebody else's podcast to listen to. But for those of you that are still here and haven't turned off your iPod by now, this is going to be very heavy on Vinnie Vincent stuff, and we're going to try to get into the minutia about what Vinnie's been up to all these years. And obviously, we're going to talk about the recent arrest and the upcoming court case, and it may be the previous court case by the time you hear this. But let me go ahead and say that when I started to work on making this into a magazine thing, I wound up getting so much material from people that I would talk to, and this became more and more intriguing to me as time went on about all the things this guy has done, really, to people over the years. And it's almost like I know it's a title, I think it was taken by the Sex Pistols back in the 70s, but it really is like the great rock and roll swindler. From if you believe what you've been told. I don't know that I necessarily believe everything I've been told about Vinnie Vincent. I would like to believe that at least half of it's false, because, well, honestly, if even half of it's true, then you're dealing with a really, really strange individual and a very unethical person, if that's the case. But this is just my opinion. I'm entitled to that under the Free Speech Act. And so anyway, so much stuff came out that eventually it was going to be a book project, and then I started talking to some friends of mine that had done Kiss-related books over the years, and even they had told me, they were like, well, really, you know, there's no mass appeal for a book on Vinnie Vincent, which kind of hurt me because I'm a fan of the guy. And really, I was a fan of his Kiss-era stuff only and never really gave a chance to the Invasion-era stuff and all the stuff that came after it. There's not a lot of it, but I kind of ignored him after he left Kiss. I love the stuff he did in Kiss. I think he... And a lot of people disagree with me, but I think he came in at he was needed at a very important time for the band. And fantastic songwriter, fantastic guitar player. But I hadn't given the Invasion stuff a shot yet. And because a lot of people say, oh, it's just wankery. And maybe that's true to a point. But as I researched this book project at the time, I started listening to some of his records from the 80s with the Invasion. And some of the stuff he did even after, which we'll get into in great detail. And really, like, got into most of it. I mean, there's some stuff, and he does go way over the top. And I think if he had This is just my opinion. If he had leashed himself a bit on some of the solo stuff, it probably would have benefited him commercially. As a fan of guitar players and shredding and stuff, I loved it, but, you know, I'm a very small percentage of your target demographic if you're trying to sell records. But, so there's a lot of interesting things to come out of the stories that you're going to hear on this episode. And while I'm on that point, let me just state, Vinnie Vincent has an open invitation, and I live, honestly, 10 minutes away from you. You have an open invitation to come on to my show anytime and set the record straight, and I'm going to be very clear on this. Anything that you hear from the folks on this episode, and I'm not trying to show favoritism towards Vinny or I'm just trying to basically be clear on this. This is all the recollections and remembrances of the people that are interviewed, and that's not to take away from me being appreciative of the people that have been interviewed for this, because I totally appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy schedules to come and talk to my little podcast and tell me your recollections of Vinnie Vincent and your interactions with him over the years, because you all are very respected in my book, and I totally appreciate you coming on. So now that I've kissed enough ass to begin this, let's go ahead and go into the first segment of the show.
Broadcasting from the rock and metal mecca, Nashville, Tennessee.
What in the hell?
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast.
Vinnie Vincent is mostly well known as the replacement for Ace Frehley and Kiss. He came into public view around 1982 when Kiss released the Creatures of the Night album, and Vinnie showed up as the replacement on the tour for Ace Frehley. His makeup image at the time was the Egyptian Ankh symbol on his makeup, and he was kind of known as the Wiz or Egyptian Wizard or Egyptian Warrior, and there's a number of different titles thrown around about him. As far as his history goes, if you go back a little further, in the late 70s, he was with the Dan Hartman group, and they were known mostly for the song Instant Replay, which was kind of a disco-era hit. And he sort of became an internet meme on YouTube when the video for this song hit YouTube, when there was some, shall we say, creative choreography going on. I attempted to get in touch with Dan Hartman drummer Hilly Michaels, but he chose not to comment, but he did state that he had fond memories of his time working with, then Vincent Cusano on the project at the time. After leaving Dan Hartman, Vinny had hooked up with three members of the band New England, who was a group that was produced by Paul Stanley in the late 70s, and went out to Massachusetts to cut some demos with them for a new rock project. But at that point, during that time when that project was being tracked, Vinny and the band had moved out to L.A. in the early 80s. And during that time, Vinny was introduced to Gene Simmons of Kiss as a possible writing partner for the upcoming Kiss record that was going to be released in 1982. A lot of people know that album is now known as Creatures of the Night. Vinny Vincent helped write I Love It Loud and Killer for Creatures of the Night. I believe also I Still Love You, which was also a song he helped co-write. And did a bit of the lead playing on the album. It's still kind of murky about how much lead playing, because there were a number of people that did lead playing on the Creatures album. But anyway, the album was released. Ace Frehley was on the cover. Mostly a lot of people believe that was due to a contractual issue with PolyGram at the time, paying Kiss for their advance, needing to have three members of the band on the cover. But the Creatures of the Night tour came out and did not do well. Their album did not do well. The tour played to the U.S. and half-filled halls. My personal opinion, I think it was one of the best records the band ever did. Most Kiss fans will tell you that. Very hard-edged, a big comeback from the Elder mistake, but just didn't go over well. And that led to the shows in South America in, I believe, early 83. And then the band decided to take off the makeup for the Lick It Up album. And Vinnie Vincent was a huge part of the Lick It Up album. Big co-writer, I believe, on 8 of the tracks. And really, really played a big role in Kiss at that time, including the title track, Lick It Up, which is still a big, big song to this day. Many people know that song, and he was a member of the band, obviously, for when the band unmasked for that album on MTV late at night. Him and Eric Carr were the new guys, and Gene and Paul were the old guys, and They did the unmasking, and he was one of the people on there. So that, you know, that's kind of a claim to fame for him. As far as what my research has found, and a lot of Kiss fans know about this stuff, Vinny basically would not sign a contract. Basically, it's pretty well known. Vinny would not sign the contract that Gene and Paul were offering to be a member of Kiss. Now, as far as why he wouldn't sign this contract, that's where it gets a little crazy, and a lot of people, you can pick which side you want to be on. Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley have their side of why Vinnie Vincent did not want to sign this contract. Vinnie Vincent has his side, and basically Vinnie's side was that he would be signing his entire life away had he done this contract with Kiss, and later on would wind up suing Kiss for the conditions that they put him in when putting him up for the recording of this record. So he officially never was a member of Kiss, if you want to be technical about it, but he obviously was because he was there for the videos, the tours, the albums, and all that. But I think it was after the European Kiss Lick It Up tour is when Vinny was, he was either dismissed or he left the band for, according to Kiss, unethical reasons, and for Vinny not wanting to sign his life away. It just depends on who you believe. And right now I want to go ahead and play a little clip of, ironically, Kiss, did their convention tour in 95, and they actually came here to my town of Nashville, which is also Vinny's town of Nashville, and there's a big Q&A session that takes place at all these conventions back in 95, and this is a person named Alan Tate who so kindly let us use this clip. It's up on YouTube, but I wanted to get permission from him, and he so kindly let us use this clip of Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley answering Alan when he asked, why did you let go of Vinnie Vincent? And also you'll hear Bruce Kulick at the end on his remembrances of the Unholy Solo from 92's Revenge album. So go ahead and check out this clip of Paul and Gene talking about Vinnie Vincent.
I just want to know why you guys fired Vinnie Vincent. How many hours do you have?
Oh, it's a fair question.
It's a fair question. Vinny was an incredibly talented guitar player and was a great talent to write with, but was not a team player and somebody who was not very honest in his dealings with the band, made us a lot of promises about what he would do and then didn't do them. And in dealing with the fans and dealing with people who've been with us for 15, 20 years, he was very disrespectful and did things that we thought were embarrassing to us. Things that we wound up apologizing for, and at some point, very quickly, it became clear that Vinny didn't belong in the band. Quite honestly, from the day that Vinny joined the band, we weren't happy about having him, but we wanted to go out on tour, and a tour had been booked, and we didn't want to have a temporary guitar player. So we had Vinny join, and our gut feeling was right. From the day he joined, he was a problem, and we don't need those kind of problems, and neither do you.
You know, specifically, just so you get it, because it's sort of, we're trying to protect Vinny as well, by not being too specific, because, you know, some of the stuff doesn't really belong out there. Everybody deserves a private life. But look, when you go out on tour, there are guys in suits and ties who insure tours. You got to insure the people who are on tour, and when a band goes out on tour, you got to insure the band in case anybody gets sick or whatever. You know, you lose a lot of money. So in order for a band to insure itself, you've got to show that it's a band. You've got to show contracts and so on. And in order for that to happen, everybody in the band has got to be signed to the band. You've got to have a piece of paper that says we're all in the same band, signed members of the band. Vinny kept saying, I'll sign it tomorrow, I'll sign it tomorrow. He did that for a long time, years. To this day, he's never signed. And finally, he just said, you know, fuck it, this is not worth it. And honestly, he's just, you know, the ethics are questionable.
At one point, now that we're talking about Vinny, okay, let's tell the truth. Actually, at one point, what Vinny did is he sold a fan a guitar that he had never played and said it was his favorite guitar, and it was a guitar he always played, and he sold it to a fan for more than it cost in a store. And it was that kind of stuff that we just said, this is, you know, totally unacceptable. And we'll see you later.
Damn. He had the balls to. At some convention, he shows up and says that the question was, So did you have anything to do with the solo on Unholy? Now, you wrote the song, and I'm not taking anything away from Vinny, but he actually had the balls to say, well, yeah, we all worked on that. And man, that pissed me off when I read that. I called the ball right away, and he said, oh, look, it's Vinny, you know, a little bit of but you got to be a complete scumbag to pull that kind of shit.
Other than that, Bruce loves Vinny.
Yeah, but otherwise, I love it. You even got credit rules for don't steal my thunder, you know? So where is that motherfucker?
Hi, this is Mick Fury, and you're listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast.
After Kiss, Vinnie Vincent went on to form the Vinnie Vincent Invasion, with Dana Strum on bass, Bobby Rock on drums, and singer Robert Fleischman. The album that was recorded was a self-titled album, Vinnie Vincent Invasion, and featured a lot of shredding and pop rock type music. There's an interesting story involving Vinnie Vincent talking about Mark Slaughter in hindsight saying that he received a audition tape or audition cassette with no contact info with Mark Slaughter singing on it, and saying that basically they stuck with Robert Fleischman for the first album because they couldn't get in touch with Mark Slaughter, and he spent $10,000 trying to track down Mark Slaughter, and then when they found him, they let Fleischman go and made Mark Slaughter the singer. And I want to quote an interview that Robert Fleischman gave with a site called www.rockpages.gr to put an interview out with him from the past couple of years. And Robert says, quote, I was never fired. Vinny had a manager whose only experience was being a road manager. And that takeaway from that quote, that manager was George Sewitt, who was Kiss's road manager in the 1980 Australian tour. Back to the quote. The manager had promised Chrysalis Records that he would tie me up in a contract. So at the photo shoot for the album, the manager came to me with this document as thick as the phone book and told me to sign it, saying, trust me, it's okay. I told him that I wanted to take it to my lawyer, a thing that is typical in these situations, but he insisted that I sign it right then and there. So I refused. Obviously, I was once again pegged as a difficult person. He went back to Chrysalis and had to tell them that I didn't sign, but he had already led Chrysalis to believe that I will sign. So he was caught in a lie and the shit hit the fan. So then I started getting calls from Chrysalis telling me to sign a deal which would tie me up without any money advances or anything. I said no to them. They threatened me by saying they would take my voice off the album, so I told them to do what they had to do. Obviously, taking my voice off would have cost them a great deal more money, but I had never heard from them after that. They found another vocalist to sign, apparently, and they had probably gave him very little money. He'd be talking about Mark Slaughter there. And then Robert goes on to say, a few months later, I had people telling me to turn on MTV. So I turn on MTV, and I see the premiere of Vinny's new video, Boys Are Gonna Rock, expecting to hear the new singer's vocals. To my surprise, my voice was coming out of this guy's mouth, and he was dressed in leather pants with panties on the outside. So that was the first Milli Vanilli-type situation. Needless to say, there was a legal dispute over it, which I won. According to Robert Fleischman, there was no big search or whatever. This was a deal where he did not want to sign the contract that was being offered. Now, I don't know that we can really peg Vinny on this as far as the problem, because it sounds to me like Fleischman was making it out that George Sewitt, the manager, was trying to work him on a deal. So it may not be Vinny. It may be Vinny. I'm not sure, but there's plenty more stories to come. Basically, Fleischman did the vocals for the first album, for the Vinnie Vincent Invasion album, for those that aren't fans. And all the video that came out for Boys Are Gonna Rock had Mark Slaughter aping to Robert Fleischman's vocals. And they went on to tour with Iron Maiden, I believe, for that tour. Mark Slaughter's real recording debut was on the second album, All Systems Go, which features a more radio-friendly vibe but wasn't pushed very much by Chrysalis Records. And I think anyone can see that, because it didn't get much of a push. Now, possibly because there are also rumors that I've heard that Vinny maxed out their credit line during the making of the album and basically shot it up to where the album would have had to have been the biggest album of all time to pay off what Vinny had charged up on the credit card for the record company. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I've heard. Also during this time was when Rick Fox, a former member of Wasp, Steeler, and Sin, among other bands, had his run-in with Vinny. Rick Fox was kind enough to take some time out to talk with me. But he actually almost stopped the All Systems Go album from coming out. Reason being because he had claimed there was a copyright infringement claim going on with Vinny ripping him off on a song that wound up on the record called Let Freedom Rock, bearing a pretty striking resemblance to the Fox penned On the Run, which if I've listened to it myself, in my own personal opinion, just an opinion, not a fact, is that I do hear the similarity, and I do believe Rick had a reasonable argument here. But obviously, if you're one person taking on a record company and their lawyers, you're probably not going to have a lot of luck. But Rick tells us this story and all the details about his encounters with Vinnie Vincent over the years. Well, I guess right off the top, before we get into stuff about your career and everything, why don't you go ahead and get your impressions on this latest bit of news about Vinnie?
Boy, what can I say? Karma?
Yeah.
You know, what can I say that hasn't already been said? I mean, for a guy who's as talented as he is, you know, he walks hand in hand with his own lunacy, I guess, if I could use that term, because, I mean, he's that talented, but why does he need to stoop to certain levels of things that get himself into trouble? I don't get it, you know. I mean, he did a project with Hirsch Gardner from New England and tried to walk off with Hirsch's songs, and Hirsch sued him and won, you know, and yet he writes songs with Kiss. I don't know to what length and breadth and depth his material was used by Kiss. I mean, you know, you're working within a severely limited forum with them, you know, and yet, you know, he writes songs with other people. But why does he need to feel that he can walk off with other people's songs? You know, it's a real paradox. You know,
yeah.
He's got this on the one hand, but yet he ruins it on the other hand. It's, you know, I've seen people or doctors and stuff in the field of their study saying that there are certain facets of people who get into the entertainment industry, they get to some certain point of success, and then they do something to sabotage it, you know. And there is a theme that has happened to many people who are in the entertainment industry. You know, a lot of actors do it too. You know, they get to a point where they get so successful, and then they do something that just hamstrings them. You know, Pee Wee Herman for one. You know, the actor who played the principal in Ferris Bueller.
Jeffrey Jones.
Jeffrey Jones. He got busted for doing things that weren't proper. You Gary Glitter, you're you know, just there's people out there that they, like I said, they do things and then they trip themselves up, and you know, we're at a loss to explain why these things happen. And apparently the same thing looks like it applies to Vinnie Vincent.
Yeah.
Now, reading the what's been published so far, at least off of the police blotters, is that his wife was inebriated and drove herself to the police station. So by admitting that she's inebriated and driving under a DUI, you know, lends us to think that, you know, there was obviously a domestic argument of some kind over the fact that Vinny was talking to a woman. But they, what we're just hearing is that, you know, he was talking to a woman, she's drunk, I guess she, you know, got into a spat with him over it. And things like this happen all the time in the news, you know, and they got into it. And apparently there was a broken dish on the floor, so maybe she threw a dish at him.
Yeah.
You know, and it broke. So then it gets ugly where he drags her, you know, out of the house and you know, such like that. So,
yeah.
And then the icing on the cake is the dead dogs in the containers. I mean, what's up with that?
That's the where it kind of goes over the top as far as bizarre goes, but I mean, I don't know how to feel about. I mean, I know they cleared both of them on animal cruelty. I'm guessing it's something to do with. All I can think of is maybe they were preparing to bury the dogs, but I'm not sure.
Until more information is forthcoming, we can't.
Yeah, I think they're still looking into it.
It's all speculation, but.
Yeah, it's. But I guess overall, can you say you were surprised to hear about this?
At least to that aspect, yeah. I mean, the guy's. What does he weigh, you know, about 105 soaking wet? I mean, he's you know, we see him in the Kiss Lick It Up video, and he seems to be very almost effeminately built. He's really small and thin and light.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine how much force this guy could have had to drag a woman outdoors, you know.
Yeah. For everything we've heard about his, you know, business ethics, I don't recall anything about violence in his background.
No, just thievery.
Yeah, there's plenty of that to go around, apparently. But well, let's go back in time with your experience with him. How did you meet him initially?
All right. What happened was we were dead smack in the middle of our Sin album master demo session, and Dana Strum was producing. I walk in one night, you know, to do, I don't know what, if I was listening for someone else's tracks, what they were tracking, or if I was doing something. I just remember walking in and seeing Vinny sitting at the control board with Dana, and I was like, okay, I know who this guy is. And Dana's like, hey, Rick, I'd like to introduce you to a friend of mine here, Vinny Vincent. He played with Kiss, you know, a big guitar player. You know how Dana does that whole lay it on thing, you know, like you're supposed to be impressed by all the BS that comes out of Dana's mouth. So, and of course, everybody who's had a deal with him says the same thing. So it's not just my impression, but. And Vinny's like, yeah, hey, how you doing, Rick? Reaches over, shakes my hand. He says, yeah, Dana's been playing me some of your material here. You guys are really cooking. I really like what I'm hearing here. You guys are going to be really big. And I'm like, okay. And I'm thinking the reason you're here is, and eventually Dana gets around to, well, I was playing some of your stuff here, and Vinny really likes On the Run. He says, it's a really good song, and then at that point, Vinny pipes in with, yeah, we were thinking of maybe if there's a possibility we might be able to, say, re-record it or something, and have you come in and be involved, you know? And I'm like, you know, what do you want me to see? Am I selling the song, or are you buying the song, or what? He says, well, we're just really interested in the song. We like it a lot. It's got a really good hook to it, and it's got a lot of drive, and, you know, just, we'd like to you know, work out something with you on the song, more or less, something to that effect. You know, I don't remember exactly the words said in the conversation, but the fact that we like the song, we're thinking of, we'd like to re-record it and have you be involved. I remember that line, have you be involved in it. But how and to what level was never clarified. Hmm. And then I said, yeah, okay, whatever. And I never heard anything about it from that point on. We finished the demo. Album master demos. I had the tape, and I guess management was going to shop it. I didn't know if and how close we were to being signed. I'm speculating that because of the Chrysalis Records connection that they were on, that Dana was going to try and shop us to Chrysalis and get us signed so he can get a piece of the pie as the finder's fee, and then come on board as the end, you know, the producer for the rest of the album. And then it wasn't until I was at the NAMM show, National Association of Music Merchants show, and annually here in Anaheim, California, some months later, that a copy of Vinny's All Systems Go demo found its way into my hands through our common publicist, which was Charmaine. She says, you better listen to this. And I put it on, I listen, and I'm listening to the introduction of Let Freedom Rock, and then Star Spangled Banner, and then it just cuts into the first three power chords of our song Break Down the Walls, and then it goes right into the hook of On the Run.
Oh, so there were two songs of yours involved with this, really?
Well, yeah, it's the first three notes, of three chords in the same progression as Break Down the Walls. And then, like I said, it cuts right into On the Run, the same hook, and I'm like, my jaw dropped. I'm like, what am I listening to here? It's dun, 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 all the signature hook chords for On the Run. And it cuts right into the song, you know, as we know it sounds, as it's played out. It's On the Run.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to this measure of some kind of other hook, and Mark Slaughter comes in with his signature, what, scream, and they cut into it changes a little bit for the verse.
Mm-hmm.
When they get back to the chorus, they're still running the chords for On the Run underneath Let Freedom Rock.
Yeah.
I was beside myself. And at that point, one night, Fred Corey, who became the drummer of Cinderella, he wasn't at that point. He was leaving the band London, and he came over to my house. We hung out every once in a while, and I said, "Fred, I'd like you to hear this." And because he was interested in possibly being a drummer for me for Sin, I put on the Run. He goes, "Oh yeah, I remember this song. This is one of my favorites. I love this song." I said, "Okay, now let me take it off. I want you to hear something else." And I played him "Let Freedom Rock," and he goes, "Oh, did you guys do another version of this?" And I held up the tape, and it said Vinnie Vincent Invasion. His eyes got like saucers. His jaw hit the floor. He says, "Dude, you just got taken to the cleaners. That's the rip I ever heard. That's clean. There's no doubt about it. That's clean. That's not George Harrison and My Sweet Lord. He's so fine. Mm-hmm. That's clean rip." You know, I bumped into Mark Slaughter and Bobby Rock, both of Vinnie Vincent Invasion, at the NAMM show. And I held up the cassette and I said, "You want to talk to me about this?" And this was individually, not at the same time. But both of them essentially apologized to me and said they had no idea what it was that they were being asked to sing and play over until it was too late. Then Dana kind of revealed after the fact, once their tracks were done. And I'm thinking to myself, how can that be? Because Mark Slaughter sang on our demo. He knew On the Run. He knows that song.
Right.
You know, the whole thing about Mark Slaughter giving an unnamed with no phone number demo to the Vinnie Vincent Invasion, to become their singer, to take the place of Robert Fleischman, it was a whole cover story. That never happened. Dana and Mark were working together on our demo because, you know, Dana had me fire Frank Starr because his range couldn't cut this stuff. Mm-hmm. So in the meantime, he brought Mark Slaughter in from Vegas, and Mark was doing tracking vocals on our demo until we got Rick Reed in, you know, who came and went. But, so that whole thing about them having a blank cassette trying to track down Mark Slaughter, that's just a cover story for magazines. So Mark, Mark knew On the Run. So I don't know if I could swallow that story completely because he knew the hook. But in any case, both Mark and Bobby Rock said, you know, they apologized to me for saying they didn't know what it was. They just, Dana played them certain tracks that they had to play along with or sing along with or whatever, and they didn't know until it was too late.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I had to accept it at face value at that point.
Well, did you go after Dana or Vinny to find out, you know, if they had anything to say about this?
I didn't know how to contact Vinny personally. I don't remember it now if I contacted our management who knew Dana. I mean, our manager was the one who kind of got us the setup so that we can go into the studio to record this stuff. Todd Cooper was our manager with Management 3, which was Jerry Weintraub's company. And this Jerry Weintraub's company handled, like, the Eagles, Neil Diamond, you know, like the biggest acts in the world. So that gave us, you know, clout in the music industry. So Todd's brother, Les, engineered the tape, you know, as Dana produced. And, I guess they said, I don't remember how all the strings are being pulled to manipulate what we were doing and where they were going to get us with this. So I don't remember now at this point if I contacted Todd Cooper and said, "What's going on with this? We just got ripped." But I did contact the radio stations here in Los Angeles, and I said, "I understand you have a copy of Vinnie Vincent's new album, All Systems Go. I'm here to tell you that if you play that album, if you play Let Freedom Rock, you will be sued." And they were like, "What?" I said, "Vinnie Vincent came into our long story short, Dana Strum produced us. Vinnie Vincent came in. Dana brought him in. He heard our song. He ripped off our song and rewrote the lyrics and changed it a little bit. That's my song."
Yeah.
And that ruffled some feathers, and phone calls started being made. I got a phone call from Dana Strum, like, later that day, threatening me. It says, "Go ahead, take us to court, sue us. Sue us all you like. We'll bleed you dry, then we'll countersue you. You can't copyright a hook. You can't sue us for a hook." And I cite examples like George Harrison with My Sweet Lord, and He's So Fine. George Harrison lost. I'm here to tell you.
Yeah, he did.
And Dana's like, go ahead, do whatever you like. He goes, I'll tell you, I was talking to Carmine Appice about this. Carmine said, pay him $1,000 and tell him to shut the fuck up.
Wow.
And I was, I'm like, why are you even discussing this with Carmine Appice?
Why, is he some sort of authority on the subject or something?
I don't know, you know, and ever since then, Carmine is like, every time I see him, he just blows me off, so I don't know what his story is. He did it to me at the NAMM show again this year, this past year.
Really?
You know, I went up to him, I said hi, and he's like, looked right through me. He didn't even acknowledge me, and his brother Vinny blew me off. So,
oh, wow.
I don't get it, but that's a whole sidebar. The fact sure. is, here's Dana telling me, go ahead, sue us.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have, you know, the powerful management and a lawyer to back me at this time, because it would have been a really interesting case in court. I'm sure, and I would have loved to have heard what Dana's defense on this would be, but to hear that those two songs played side by side will clearly tell you one was taken from the other. So over time, the album never went anywhere. It tanked. It just, you know, I was like, well, at least it tanked. You know, that's the only salvation I had at that particular time. Up mm-hmm. until such time that I got contacted in the mail by a law firm who was working with or against Vinnie Vincent on his bankruptcy case. And my name came up in the case, filing in there against him as one of the plaintiffs in a class action suit because, you know, of what he did with the Kiss Army, and he owes all these people this money. And now more stuff is starting to come out of the closet into the daylight about his reputation and what he's been doing to people. And I'm starting to see the pattern and the puzzle pieces fall together. And I'm seeing that I'm just one part of that puzzle piece in a bigger picture.
Oh, you're dead on with that. Because I've found out quite a few stories that are very similar to what you went through with him.
You know, and then, of course, I heard the story, the famous story about, you know, him working with Hirsch Gardner from New England and trying to put a project together. And then he just ups and leaves town and takes the songs with him. And Hirsch is like, hey, wait a minute, where's the songs?
Yeah.
You know, and then he wound up suing Vinnie Vincent and won.
Mm-hmm.
And when Invasion hit Boston, opening for Iron Maiden, an hour before showtime, as I understand, all of their gear, everything they had, all their music gear was all painted pink.
Yep.
Cars, everything that was on the stage was confiscated an hour before showtime. And they had to scramble to find any music stores that were still open to get any kind of gear just to play the gig.
And, yeah.
You know, Iron Maiden was going to throw them off the tour. So,
such a strange pairing with those two groups on one bill as it is, you know.
I don't know the complete outcome of what happened, you know, with Hirsch and what happened with the gear and everything. But the fact is, justice was served there, but it wasn't equally served with me in the case against Vinnie Vincent.
Yeah, so you showed up at his bankruptcy proceedings in Los Angeles, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and what went down when you showed up at that? What was his reaction upon seeing you?
I can tell you he wasn't pleased.
Yeah.
I sat on the side. I guess it was a jury box with you know, it was quite a few people there, I guess. And Vinny and his lawyer were sitting out, like, in the middle of the room. We were on their left. They were in the room facing the judge, who was also on our left. And when my name was brought up as one of the names in the plaintiffs in the case, Vinny leaned over, and when the judge asked him questions about that, Vinny leaned over into his lawyer's ear and whispered something. And as he was whispering in the lawyer's ear, he was looking past the lawyer at me. I distinctly remember that. And then the lawyer kind of, like, just for a fraction of a second, looked over at me, like, and back to the judge and said, we would appreciate if we could discuss that in judge's chambers later on. And judge went, okay. And that was it. That was all I got to hear about it. And eventually the case came and went, and then he had like a zillion people after him for all kinds of money that he owed out. And I started hearing the stories about the Kiss Army and him trying to sell stuff and people sending money and them not receiving any product for whatever it was he promised to send them. You know, stories about guitars, you know, he was going to sell that he never played, things like that. And, you know, push came to shove, it came to a head, and he was no longer in Kiss, and they were distancing themselves, and pretty much everybody involved with Vinny was distancing themselves except his lawyers.
What we do is we need that extra push over the cliff. You know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly.
The only podcast that goes to 11.
One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast.
Three months after All Systems Go was released, the band officially announced their breakup. The tensions must have taken over, and some of those tensions may be, as far as Mark and Dana were concerned, explained by the lyrics to Burning Bridges by Slaughter. I'm not going to quote them here, but if you want to look them up, look up Burning Bridges by Slaughter, and it's been pretty well documented that those lyrics were written about Vinnie Vincent. Things get a bit murkier after the breakup of Invasion as far as Vinny goes. As everyone pretty much knows, Mark and Dana went on to form Slaughter, went on to pretty big success, and Bobby joined Nelson and went on to reasonable success with them. In 1989, Vinny Vincent filed for bankruptcy in Los Angeles. As you heard in the interview, Rick Fox was one of the attendees in the courtroom that day. And from there, Vinny started a new project, tentatively called Guitars from Hell, around 1991. Simultaneously, he reconnected with Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley in L.A. and started to help with the writing sessions for Kiss's upcoming Revenge album. It's also rumored that Vinny mentioned to Gene in conversation that his new solo album would be entitled Revenge and that Gene stole the idea from Vinny, but I can't really base that on anything because it's just a rumor that I've heard, so I'm not going to say that it's a fact. Anyway, Guitars from Hell saw a reunion of sorts with Vinny and Robert Fleischman once again working on some of the songs. This project would be short-lived, however, and according to the previously mentioned Rock Page's interview with Fleischman, Vinny, quote, started thinking that he wanted to talk to other record labels, although he had already had a contract with the label that was financing the album. Well, the other label started inquiring with the label he was with about the status of Vinny, and obviously he got himself into a bit of trouble, which ended the deal. Those are Robert Fleischman's words. Guitars from Hell basically fizzled out at that point, and years later some of the tracks were used for an EP called Euphoria, which was a teaser for a full-length album to be called Guitarmageddon. One of the people involved with this project in 91, as well as work with the Revenge demos with Vinny and Gene Simmons, was an L.A. area musician named Kelly Raven, who took some time out to share some of his recollection of both projects.
My experience with Vinny, I had just actually begun my solo career, which I was previously a drummer, okay? And I had just gotten picked up to do a production deal for Giant Warner Brothers with a producer, Howard Rice, who had success with Kiss back in the 80s. And so we're working on my solo album, me and Howie. And one day I get this call on my day off to come up to the studio because he had two buddies of his there. and they wanted to meet me and have me come up and start writing with them. So I rush up to the studio on my day off, and boom, there it is. It's Gene Simmons and Vinnie Vincent. So I'm floored, you know, because I worshipped Kiss, you know, through the 70s and 80s. And as a kid, that's kind of what got me into playing rock and roll, one of my big influences. So anyway, to cut to the chase, excuse me, I went up and I started doing some demos for the Revenge record, which, you know, as you know, Vinny, he wrote a lot of stuff for Kiss. The guy is just such an amazing songwriter. I must give him that. So we dove into that. Vinny pulls me over to the side, I guess, like second or third day in, and says, hey, man, you know, I'm doing my new solo comeback thing, Guitarmageddon. I understand, you know, I had been programming drums and stuff as well for Gene and Vinny. And he said, you know, why don't you come on board and play drums with me? So me being young and hungry and all that stuff, I jumped right on it. So we then started cutting, working on Vinny's new Guitarmageddon, cutting demos and so forth for that record, and everything started going really bad. One, he was constantly writing bad checks to me, and even got to a point where he physically stole a piece of equipment from me, which really was the clincher. I had taken quite some time developing my guitar sound for my solo record, my Kelly Raven debut album. And, he was like, I kind of like this rack, And so one day he took off with it. And I called him on it. And, he fought me on it, told me that he borrowed it and I told him he could have it or something, some crazy story, which was false. And so anyway, we continued on. And there was just a lot of him not showing up. We were working with Robert Fleischman, the original singer for The Invasion, and those two weren't getting along, and I started to realize that Vinny was just, he wasn't paying us, he was just being really, really, I was just so disappointed, and the fact that he stole from me, really, I got to a point where I wanted to, punch his lights out, which isn't cool, especially when you're working with someone who you look up to. So anyway, we got into that, to the Guitarmageddon thing, and then we the contracts came out for the live performances, and fortunately, my manager at the time, Mark James, who is the son of Billy James, who was one of the guys responsible for signing the Doors, and I don't remember what label they were on or whatever.
I think it was Elektra.
Yeah, Elektra, exactly. Yeah. He was an old school Elektra guy, and really good manager. He looked over the contract and he said, "Well, look, man, I got you down to finish your solo stuff, and it's great that Vinny wants you to go on tour and blah blah blah. But you didn't see this in the contract. But contract basically said that Vinny would own Kelly Raven for the rest of my career. Therefore, after our tour dates." And me being hungry, this was my big shot. I was like, well, I'll do it. Who cares? You know what I mean? And fortunately, my manager said, and the fact that, his credibility just isn't all that, And I kind of saw it, obviously, because he stole from me. But I kind of let it go because I was still a little bit in awe, just to be working with the guy. But, the amount of bad checks that he wrote me, and just some of the things that he did, like not showing up and just not being honest, really hurt our friendship and our working relationship. So I ended up going into rehearsals, or we had begun going into rehearsals with Robert Fleischman and another unknown, I won't mention his name because it's not important, as the bass player. And there was just no communication. Vinny was just completely out of control. I remember bringing a girlfriend up to the studio who was like a huge Vinnie Vincent fan. And it was one of the days he didn't have his wig on. And she just like lost it. She could not believe it. I had only, I had always been a big Kiss fan. And when The Invasion came out, I didn't really follow them. I just knew their stuff. I had the cassette and everything. But my excitement for him was that he worked with Kiss, who was like the greatest band in the world to me, back in the 70s and 80s. And then once I got in and I started working with him, Gene was an absolute angel. You know, we don't stay in close touch, but you know, I run into him every now and then. And I'm very fortunate to have gotten to jump in on that, revenge thing and work with him, basically through the producer, Howie Rice.
Yeah.
Who was a heavy, heavy dude in the 80s. He did everything from Kiss to he was responsible for like Pointer Sisters, and even I think he did some tracks for like some big house band called Enigma. Do you remember them? So he was
yeah.
like an across the board monster pop producer, and you know, he taught me a lot of my tricks and stuff and. So yeah, basically the whole thing with Vinny was, man, you know, I had the opportunity to jump into bed with him and work with him, but he just was not on the up and up. He stole from me, didn't pay, and it was a good thing that my manager did not let me enter the agreement that he put forth. And originally wanted me to do. So I ended up getting out of it without killing him, you know, because there was a point where, you know, I was like, if I see him, I'm gonna beat him up, you know what I mean? and people would be like, well, you know, then we won't go there because he'll be there or what have you. And that's basically it. That's really it.
Well, since you were in kind of an interesting position of an era that people know of but don't know a lot about, let me ask you a little bit about the two things where do you recall what the tension was between him and Robert at the time?
I think because Vinny was very he had a lot of animosity towards Slaughter and those guys,
mm-hmm.
okay? And I think Robert might have felt like second choice, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the time, I personally didn't spend very much time with the guy. I spent a lot of time with Vinny because I did all the drums. I played a lot of rhythm guitars with him. And, I would sense that it was more so like Vinny was very, very bitter that the Slaughter guys took off, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm 100% sure that's why he wanted a percentage of my career, because he saw, you know, this Kelly Raymond guy might just go ahead and take off and bypass me. You know, you never know.
Yeah, he got paranoid.
Exactly. And those were the red flags. So I can't speak for Robert, but I would more or less think it was kind of, he felt... you know, Vinny was just very selfish, very selfish. You know, he, like I said, he would make plans, not show up, tell us things, not come through. You know, for all I know, he might have owed this guy a lot more money than he owed me, you know.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you had did for the revenge demos with him and Gene?
I played some guitars, him, myself, and Gene. I did a lot of work on the Unholy song, and did a lot of the electronic drum tracks.
Okay, and
yeah,
at the time it was interesting because a lot of people were like thinking, you know, why is Gene working with Vinny again? I mean, obviously because he's a great songwriter, but when Gene talks about that era, he just sort of glosses over saying, you know, the same things came up from the past with Vinny, and then it just sort of got cut off.
Right.
Did you sense tension between the two of them at the time?
Actually, no, I did not. But now that I think back on it, I could probably say there was.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I was the new guy. I was the quiet guy. I was doing whatever Gene and Howie asked me to gladly.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I did every now and then see the Gene wanted it this way, Vinny had to have it this way, a clear room type of thing, and I don't know what went on. you know, so I really don't want to overstep anything and say. But now that I look back, I can't see why there wouldn't be. I even remember saying to Gene, you know, he stole from me. and then Howie and the engineer were like, okay, well, you want us to take him in the other room and chop his head off, you know? and they meant it. But I can't really say I saw anything that I can define.
Right. Now. And I think some of these stories get because at the time, I mean, you were just in it and it was just, you know, demo work for you and everything. And it's just more like going to the office for you guys. But I think those of us that are fans, we build it up to be much more dramatic, I guess, in hindsight.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were a few, you know, there were a few really good days. I mean, you know, we worked on that stuff for months and then, you know, the thing was, this is what it was. I was like basically working on the Kiss thing, and Vinny had me like coming back after those sessions. So it was almost like he was doing it behind their back type of thing. You know what I mean? Well, hey, Kelly, can you come up and help me on this? And can you and I do this and that? You know, I mean, you know, he'd come pick me up at my house at 8 o'clock in the morning. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In his little red, what was that? The Mercedes. And, you know, we'd go in and we'd work all day and blah, blah, blah. And he'd write me a check. I'd go to the bank and it would bounce. And this started getting old, you know, and like I said, my girlfriend was even like, she was just like, oh my God, this is not cool, man. You know? Mm-hmm. But it was definitely, I did learn a lot during those sessions, and I learned a little bit, you know, because I'm no angel, what not to act like and how not to be to my players and so forth, because my understanding is not too many people really care for the guy. So, and I'm sorry that I have to, you know, talk in depth on this level about him, because like I said, I absolutely adored him and he's very talented.
Well, I appreciate you coming on and giving me a few minutes of your time. And for people that would want to check out your music and stuff, especially like the track you did with Lemmy, where would they find that?
You can Google Kelly Raven, KELIRAVEN, Kelly Raven and Lemmy Kilmister. And that's on YouTube and other fan sites, or you can go directly to reverbnation.com/KellyRaven. And there's a whole different world there. We like to call it modern erotica rock. And we're really excited about getting out there this summer and playing the new record Scream, Kelly Raven Scream, to the people, and as well as the track with Lemmy and other stuff that I'll be putting out in the near future.
Okay, folks, that's the end of part one of this Vinnie Vincent special. I hope you enjoyed that. I want to thank Rick Fox and Kelly Raven for being the guest on this part of the episode. You can find out more about Kelly Raven at www.reverbnation.com/KellyRaven, KELIRAVEN. If you want to find out more about Rick Fox, there's a couple places you can find out more about him. You can check out www.fullinbloommusic.com/Rick, R-I-K, Fox. Rick is also available on MySpace and Facebook, and you can check that out, and he'll be friends with you if he feels like it. And if not, then just read up about him on that big interview on Full and Bloom Music. You can also find out more about him at www.husaria.us, H-U-S-A-R-I-A. Lots more coming up on part two of this Vinnie Vincent special on the Decibel Geek podcast. I will have some more surprise guests coming on and sharing their remembrances of Vinnie, and also my updated take on where things stand now, because with Vinnie, things are always evolving. See you on the next part.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.